Hello, Freedom Nation. It's Jeff here once again with another episode of the Freedom Nation podcast. And today I've got a fellow Texan on the interview, which is going to be a lot of fun. We're not too far apart from each other. Chance McLean. Now, Chance has been in the production field, video and things like that for many years. He worked for other people and then launched off and started his own production company, as well as another side business that I think you're going to be really interested in, where he interviews people for their posterity and their family. So I think you'll really enjoy this. Stay tuned. We'll be right back on in a second.
Welcome to the Freedom Nation Podcast with Jeff Kickle. On this show, Jeff shares his expertise in financial and retirement planning from a different perspective. Planning for your Freedom Day, which is the first day that you wake up and have enough income or assets and do not have to go to work that day. Learn how to calculate what you need, how to generate income sources, and listen to interviews from others who've done it themselves. Get ready to experience your own Freedom Day.
Hello, Freedom Nation. Welcome to the show, and I've got Chance McLean on. How are you, Chance?
Well, howdy there, Jeff. I just loved it. No, I'm just kidding. Well, you said I'm from Texas, so.
Oh, I know.
Well, you know, it's funny. You get to talking to some people out in deep East Texas, and my East Texas roots, they start coming through. And next thing I know, I'm just like, well, man, it's so nice to meet you.
Oh, I know. Same thing for me. I mean, I was born in Hawaii and spent like the first few years there. And then, you know, over the years gone back, and I can roll right into the patois.
Good.
You know, within about a half a day, I'll roll right into the patois and I sound like I've been there forever. So
I feel you, man.
All right. Well, why don't we lead off? Tell us a little bit about your story. How did you get from college to getting, you know, working for a lot of other people and then going off and really starting your own show?
Yeah, man, I could do the 3-hour version or the 30-second version, but I like,
let's go somewhere in the middle.
Somewhere
of that.
In the middle, sure. Yeah. So I grew up north of Houston and did, like, I was the everything in high school, dude. I was, you know, multi-year letterman, multi-sports. I was the lead in every play. I was the president of my class all 4 years, academic All-American, went to Austin, University of Texas on a full ride academic scholarship and failed out immediately. Bob, face plant, dude. And then I decided that perhaps matriculating at such an esteemed university wasn't right for me. So I transferred to Stephen F. Austin, which is, for your audience outside of Texas, it's kind of a party school. And I did. And I had no more luck there. But I met a girl, fell in love, eloped, you know, like all responsible people
nice.
Do. And I eloped. We got married on one day. 11 days later, I'm off to boot camp. Joined the Army. I served 4 years proudly between the wars, so no overseas
nice.
Service. The way I like to tell, I was a light infantry medic in the Army, and I was in Seattle during grunge. That's how awesome it was. I was up at Fort Lewis, Washington.
Nice.
And, yeah, it was beautiful. Loved it. Very proud to serve. Still connected with some of my soldier friends from back then. But yeah, I got out. You know, I'm now married. When I got out of the Army, I had a son. And I had time to get more responsible, right? So I had a series of sales jobs and everything. I worked in uniform sales. I worked in downhole oil fields. So worked in an oil patch for a while. While I'm doing all this, I'm like doinking around with music and things like that. And I wrote a song that went viral.
Okay.
It was about Yao Ming, the basketball player in 2003. And what viral to your younger audience meant in 2003, this is pre like Friendster. Okay. This is back in the day. It means it was in all the newspapers and it was on CNN and ESPN and the David Letterman show. It was like, you know, it went viral. Of course, there's no money in that, but I did parlay it into a radio job. Right. So I got hired as the creative director of a CBS sports radio station. I'm big into sports too. Within a few years after that, me and some buddies started our own radio station. So now I was the program director. While we're doing radio, think about where you are in time in the mid-2000s. It's this convergence of digital technology and NLE editing and audio editing and digital audio works. While I was doing all that crap, So I started getting into video.
Yeah.
Made a movie, a musical movie, released it online, got nominated for a Streamy, got to go to LA for a big red carpet thing. That was a lot of fun. Wrote a off-Broadway musical like most people that dip Copenhagen do. I found myself in New York with a teen romp musical, which was a blast. 2011, I leave radio because I'm now super into video and started doing kind of, I listened to a bunch of your interviews, Mr. Kickle, and I'm not your first video guy, right? These people that have this in their background. And I was like them, anything on any screen, give me money, I'll do my best and try to make it great. And so I started doing some TV commercials, some political crap, some just anything, literally internet videos, give me money, I'll do it. And then in 2014, a buddy of mine from the radio world said, hey, my dad is turning 75. And can you sit down with him and just talk to him about growing up in East Texas and what life was like? My kids, they're not, you know, they're not at an age where they care about their football particularly, but they eventually will be.
Yeah.
So I'm like, okay, sure, you got it. So he's like,
you got the money, honey. Yeah. I got the time.
No, this was no money. This was a total favor. Total favor. I'm like, yeah. He's like, you'll do it. I said, yes, of course, Michael, I'll be happy to. So he's like, okay, he'll be at my house tomorrow at noon. And he's terrified. He doesn't want to do it. And he had a very rote job for a 45-year career at DuPont. Good luck. And I'm like, oh, all right, great. So showed up.
This is going to be miserable.
Oh, man. I was terrified, dude. I was kind of afraid of old people back then. Not afraid of them, but like, you know, different sense of humor. I was afraid I'd drop an F-bomb or something. I want to be respectful. Yeah. Anyway, set the camera up. Hey, literally just started chit-chatting. Like, so you grew up in... Well, that turned into the first Heritage film. And he talked about it on air and said, oh, y'all don't know. I do skits and stuff on his show. I do songs and crap. He's like, he sat down with my dad and made this amazing thing. So a few people are like, hey, can you... I want to do that with my mom. So I'm like, yeah. I pulled a price out of my butt and did it. I did some people's moms. And then... the less funny part, about a year later, my dad tells us that he's got stage 4 pancreatic cancer. It's my stepdad, but my dad for all intents and purposes.
Still, yeah.
Yeah. And is crushing. He's like, they say, I've got 12 to 18 months. We're just floored. It's Thanksgiving. We're at around the campfire out at my property. And I said, hey, man, it's a stepdad, right? So I don't know much about his past. So I said, dude, would you sit down and do this? And he said, of course. Well, Michael, my friend, the radio host, agreed to do the interview. And a long story short, 2 months later in January, they sat down to film on Tuesday and he died Sunday. It was,
oh my gosh,
it was 2 months, not a year. And it was only after that we were at the viewing where we're sitting in his Tahoe drinking bourbon and said, you know, there might be other people that want to do this. So talked to my wife, we prayed, we were like, let's give it a go. And we launched the company. And now, wow, this is what we do. We've done more than 800 films, 40 states. It's just grown and it's the best thing in the world. I love my job.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't not. At that point, it's such, you know, I mean, for you, it was, you know, something that you recorded for your kids that they may or may not, you know, they may not be old enough at that point to really appreciate, you know, and I think everybody has a story. That's what I do on this show. I think everybody has a story, and I don't care if you know, worked for DuPont for 40 years or whatever it is, you know, there's a story in that.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely. And think about everything you do, like with every video production, with TV commercial or Heritage film or internet, anything. There's an audience and there's something for sell. It doesn't mean a cash transaction, but what are we trying to sell? Well, you establish in a Heritage film, you're trying to sell the stories, the lore, the guidance, the anecdotes, the values, the morals. That's what's for sale. The audience is their progeny, their kids, their nieces, their nephews, their grandkids, their future great, great, great grandkids. That's the audience.
Yeah.
And knowing that going in, makes it a blast. Even talking through hard stuff ends up being fun. But you nailed it. And no story is too small. No, like literally, some dude is a CPA for 50 years and you're sitting there going, man, that guy, actuary, this is, wow, this is deep. But it's dad. Like, do it professionally. Treat it with total respect. Anyway, there you go.
Well, I mean, you know, I write military fiction. And, you know, I mean, I, you know, military background, write military fiction. But, you know, I mean, thank God that that the National D-Day Museum down in New Orleans recorded all those veterans. Because, you know, I mean, I've been able to go back and just go in and listen to, you know, thousands of hours of just these experiences. And it didn't have to be the guy that was scrambling across the beach on, you know, on the first day, you know, first wave Normandy, June 6, 1944. But, you know, maybe the supply guy that came in, you know, June 9th of 1944, who came in and then brought supplies to all those guys that had been there for 3 days fighting hard and everything else. So,
man, it's killing me right now because I am an interviewer and I'm like, okay, tell me more. Well, Jeff, all right, so you write military fiction. Dude, when I was in the Army, I was stuck in the back of my Humvee ambulance on a 45-day FTX, and I had the whole series of W.E.B. Griffin, The Brotherhood of War.
Yep.
I love those books. That is...
I sold a bunch of my library this year because, you know, whenever we move, my wife told me, if we move again or when we move again, you're going to have to move all those books, and I came to the realization that I could not physically move 4,000 volumes again. So I did the hard thing and said, you know what, I'm going to go ahead and sell off most of the library because if I want it, I can get it on Kindle and then it's all in my phone or whatever. Yeah. The two series of books that you will have to pry from my cold, dead hands are The Brotherhood of War and the Barry Sadler's Kaska series that I collected from the time I was like in like ninth grade. I started collecting the whole series of 28 books, Barry Sadler, who wrote the Ballad of the Green Berets, all that stuff. He wrote a whole series about a mercenary that was basically, he was immortal because he was the centurion that stabbed Jesus on the cross. And so it made him immortal for the rest of his life. And one of the best series book. I mean, it's, you know, I got to the end. It was just, he was just pumping them out to make money at that point. So they weren't as good as they were at the beginning, but you know, those are the type of things that really made me who I am. And, you know, I've written a crap ton of nonfiction, but yeah, I mean, I started writing fiction cause I've loved the military and, have a Fort Lewis connection cause I was a Ranger and, had some really good friends that were at Lewis,
Third Ranger Battalion,
With well, Second Battalion.
I was the whole time I was there. I was assigned to Second Battalion, not the whole time. About 2 years. I wasn't in the Rangers. I was the actual medical support for when you idiots would really break your ankles. Like,
pretty much. Yeah,
your docs were going through war games, and they would be, oh no, we actually got, or we were down in Fort Polk with Second Ranger Battalion, and dude got bit by a Black Widow. Well, his doc is like going to do war games and I'm trying to deal with this dude screaming. Oh man.
That is freaking hilarious.
It's funny. It's funny that you mentioned the first wave of we've done 27 World War II vets. And one of them just last year, I was watching the RNC on TV and they bring out this old dude and I'm like, holy crap. Bill Peckrell, we did his film. We did the guy. We did him.
Wow.
We did his film a year before, and he was a second wave 44. Dude, all harrowing tales of insanity of just this little dude did that. Okay. All right, stud.
Yeah, that, I mean, well, that's the funny part. You see him today, and they're, you know, I mean, they're yes and no. I mean, you see some of these guys that are these frail little dudes, and you're like, I mean, first off, he was like 17 or 18 years old at the time that he was doing these grand things or, you know, most of them would go, it's, you know, I didn't really do much in the war and all that. Yeah, you did.
Yeah, you did.
I need to tell you this. Many of you were away from home for 4 straight years.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah, there's a lion in a lot of those little old men. I swear to God, there's a lion in there.
Well, and we would still see a few of the paratroopers, and you know that once a paratrooper, always a paratrooper. I don't care if you're 90 years old. They just have that, that swagger in them. And they're just, you know, those are the first generation guys. So,
very cool.
So tell me, are you able to, I mean, is the audience only that crowd, or have you been able to kind of serialize these or put these together into anything? Or
I mean, I certainly could, but a part of what makes these special is that captured audience of their family. It allows them to get more intimate, allows them to get more, you know, we cry. I mean, it's a real moment that happens over the course of filming. And so part of our model is that it's special. Now we have clips and we have elements from films that we do, we get permission and share them. But yeah, no, it, these are for the families. I think, honest to God, dude, I think I've made more movies than any human being on earth.
I was going to say 800 of these things. And it's not just like a little 15-20 minute.
No, these are hour to hour, some of 3 hours, like long weeks of editing. I've got a team. It's literally like what you see on Netflix. It's just your dad or you. It is pretty
awesome.
Special. Totally. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, like I said, but I mean, okay. So somebody, I think of, you know, just like Steve Irwin's kids.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they didn't really get to, I mean, especially his son didn't really get to know him really, but he's got 14, 15 years of Steve on TV and really getting this. And you can see how he's begun to mimic somewhat. I mean, I think part of
dad,
it was in it, but yeah, he's like a little version of Steve, you know, and he's getting to be a bigger guy now, but I mean, he's kind of from watching all that video and all that stuff. So I think it's a massive amount of value, I mean, just that connection, you know, I think of watching those home movies as kids and, you know, my dad was like a big videographer in the 60s and 70s. And, you know, so he took all these videos and watching like the older grandparents and older family, they were hilarious because they'd never been on video before. And so they're like standing there like they're in a picture and he's no, come on, move around a little bit, do something to at least be somewhat interesting. Cause these are silent things too. So you can't, I need you to move.
I've seen it all. Yeah. Hunter, I can picture those people, man. And over the years from the volume, we've learned things like the attire, like what people were wearing back in the day. Like when you see some lady now who was 17 in 1968, that's like go-go boots and crazy short skirts. And you get these pictures, you're like, dude, grandma got it going on.
Well, I mean, the funny thing, like my old boss, when I worked for Fidelity Investments, we were sitting there just talking. It was like we were at an event and, you know, it was away from work and everything out. And we're at this event and Jim and I are sitting here talking. And next thing he starts talking about when he was at Woodstock.
Oh,
and I'm
seriously,
man, you were at Woodstock. And I mean, Jim was like, he was total hippie,
totally
crazy man. And then by the end of his working career, he's like this pretty tight-laced financial guy, you know, and short hair and suits and ties and everything like that. And I'm like, dude, you were at freaking Woodstock.
Yep.
I want to talk about that. I don't want to talk about anything we do.
Yeah. That is you're exactly yes, all the above. Yeah. And what happens in a tip for you and your audience, look at people's eyes, like their eyeballs when you talk to them, because our eyes don't change a ton. And you can actually connect and not look at somebody like they're 60, 70, 80, 90, 100 years old and just freaking talk. And it's liberating to talk to people. Like when I started this, I would kind of go in there and use grandma speak. So you're doing that? And then you learn real quick, like, oh my God, they're just
grandma
just
was
talk.
A badass hippie with go-go boots on.
Yeah. Or even like the generation before that, they're like, so how did you and Bill meet? Well, he would come courting and I'm like, okay, I do by my third film. I'm like, he was trying to get in your pants, wasn't he? She's like, well, yeah,
hell yeah.
They can talk like people.
Yeah. And they're not, you know, they weren't all this little, you know, buttoned up, you know, with Leave It to Beaver, you know, all that stuff. No, they were actually,
they were.
And, And you go back, even if you read way back in history, I mean, you start reading some of the literature and it's like, okay, they're not too different from us.
No, that's it. All the world's a stage. That whole thing, it's true. The costumes change, the vernacular changes, but
they're the same. Yeah,
absolutely. It makes things like, not to get all corny, but it makes things like the Bible more real when you realize that, like, oh, it's still people. It's still people like into the same crap we are now. It makes it more relatable.
Yeah. Well, and the best part is, stuff doesn't necessarily change. Times change, the venue may change, but people don't really change. I mean, people are wired the way they are, and they've been wired that way since we were, you know, sitting beating each other on clubs, or on the head with clubs back in a cave.
Yeah, we just got more sophisticated clubs now.
That's exactly right. except for the Marine Corps, which basically
they eat their crayons and clubs.
Yeah, exactly. So tell me this, you've done 800 of these interviews. Is there one that sticks out above all the rest of them?
They all stick out. There's a gentleman that I filmed that turned into a mentor. I sadly lost him last year. But when I filmed him in August, he was supposed to be gone by Christmas. But he beat liver kidney cancer and died of something unrelated. But we were in a huge rush to do this film. Yeah. And he became a mentor. And
nice.
And that one, he's a farmer and with thousands of acres of seed rice, but just a wise guy, but not like a wise guy. He was a wise man who gave me some real good advice. Like, I knew him for a day and he's telling me things. Like, I asked him about, he said some stuff. His wife was in bad shape, so he was having to get up at 3 a.m. instead of 5, and we weren't rolling at the time. He's sitting there on his iPhone. He's just like telling me, I had to get up at 3 for that year while she was going through this. And he's just on his phone, and I'm like, dude, getting up at 3, that must have been hard. He goes, well, what has hard got to do with anything? Dude, he's like, hard. Yeah. That's a random adjective. This crap is gonna get done.
Yeah,
and I'm like,
and it has to get done. There is no option. That's the thing I love about farmers and ranchers. They just live in a different world from the rest of us because there is no failure. There is no, I got sick today and I couldn't get up, or I have an I don't give a shit day.
That's it.
Because I just, don't care. I mean, the reality is, stuff relies on me to be there and nobody else is going to do it unless it's me.
That's exactly right there.
Awesome.
Yes, sir. Definitely. Love my families.
As FDR said, or the guy who was playing FDR in the film Pearl Harbor.
I was in that.
You were?
Yes.
No, I love when it's supposedly a sub commander that came up with the idea of the Doolittle raid FDR in the movie's like, I like sub commanders. They don't have time for bullshit.
Yes. Yeah, so true. So the little aside is, it was 2000. Oh boy.
Okay.
The story. All right. So there's a thing in the newspaper. Remember those things? Those are those paper things.
Oh, yeah.
There's a thing in there that they wanted former soldiers and sailors. I had gotten out of the Army in 97. I was still relatively in Army shape. They wanted former soldiers and sailors to apply to be extras in a big Hollywood movie that they were going to shoot on the battleship Texas. And
nice.
I'm like, yeah. So I signed up for it, got picked. Okay. I had to, what do you call it? Whenever your wife's pregnant and they have a due date, they had to accelerate the due date of my daughter so I could go be an extra in this freaking movie.
It was so cool.
That was awesome.
Because I mean, that's basically the only surviving ship that would even, I didn't know it was filmed on the Texas, but
parts
it's the only
it were,
surviving
yeah.
ship that would even look like the battleship.
Yeah,
Arizona.
Totally. That's right.
So that is freaking hilarious. I didn't know that at all. That's an awesome.
Yeah.
I'm glad I went off on one of my weird, my weird little tangents on, off of this stuff, but that's
I'm always afraid in free form interviews because I, dude, I have a story for everything, either with myself or the 1,000+ people I've talked to.
That you've talked to.
I'm like, my wife is like, Chance, baby, stop talking. Shut up.
Just no more. Just stop now.
Yeah.
Well, what's new? What are you working on now that's kind of new in your world then?
Yeah. So love that question because it is brand new. And it even, dude, this is so radio. It ties in with something you just said. We just launched another company, but it's the same company, but it's called Farm and Ranch Films. So Farm and Ranch Films, you literally just said that. Farm and Ranch, you said those words together. Farmandranchfilms.com. Because of these hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of movies, a lot of them were agrarian ag families. And so over the decade, I'm finding myself on a ranch, on a farm, on a dairy farm, in a rice field in Iowa. And I started to, it's very, very obvious that the land is a character in this show. And
absolutely.
So within our heritage film process, you can't do this volume without a process. I recognize we are breaking our process a lot.
Yeah.
We need a different one. So now we've launched Farm and Ranch Films and we're doing really anybody that makes their living off their land. But chiefly it's multi-generational. You know, in Texas, we have our big 100-year ranches, which are a big deal.
Yeah.
We've done so many of those that it needed its own thing. And so, yeah, that's what's new in my world is farm and ranch.
But I think that's kind of a unique character that you can, that connects so many of these families. And I think that's extraordinarily important because, you know, let's say 3, 4, 5, 6 generations down the road from the founding of that ranch, if you don't really understand what your ancestors did to get that, it's really easy to have somebody just come up and say, hey, I'll give you, a $500,000 for this property. And you don't realize the history and of what you're giving up as a result of that.
Absolutely true. And that multi-generational component is important to the families. Like what you just cued on, but if you don't have it, if you don't have people don't freaking diary anymore. Like they don't do it. What you're down to is court records and deeds and titles and maybe some newspaper articles
or possibly ancestry or whatever, trying to pull that together. Yeah,
totally right.
Well, it was funny because it's not funny. My mother-in-law died last year, but when she was gone, we went to her house and the woman never threw away a thing in her life ever. So we're trying to just go through stuff and me being the kind of historian, it's like, okay, now that looks good. And so we just brought a crap ton of stuff back.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I was trying to tell my wife, her family story because they don't really know their story, and they didn't know about their dad who was a raving wild alcoholic, but he was still a soldier. And I felt like I needed to tell his story.
Wow.
Because I never met the guy. And everything I heard from my wife was he was a wild raving alcoholic. But as I started going through the military records, he was also a pretty badass soldier too, and I felt like, we have to tell the story of both sides, he's a badass soldier, but he was also a raving, he wasn't a very nice man, but he was also, he had a history and a pretty amazing military background and all that. So I put that together for my wife and her family. And, then it's just, you start pulling on threads and going back and all this and found out that her family, which was mostly from like Nebraska and stuff, they went back all the way to like the founding of America.
Wow. Good for you.
I mean, like literally she could be part of the Daughters of American Revolution because of this. And she's like, I didn't know any of that.
Good for you. Good
now, at least with, at least with you kind of grabbing some of these histories right here, it's not somebody having to go through records and try and work your way backwards. You've got the story you've got everything and maybe a 2-hour movie or something like that for the family.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
From, so,
yeah. And this
very cool, man. It sounds like a really interesting project that you're working on and kind of I like that twist because I don't know of anybody else that's out there doing anything like that.
I don't think it's something that you could naturally do. I don't think Heritage Films is a company that could naturally be started. It was started by a need. And isn't that what all good companies are? Like identify a need, then become great at it. And that's where we are in Farm and Ranch. It was a very natural evolution. And by the way,
especially since you've done a bunch of them. Yeah.
We're working up Honors Division too, which is Okay. Which is for later next year, which is my soldiers, sailors, and Marines and airmen, because Brilliant. I've done lots of flag officers, lots of master sergeants, like career military people. Mm-hmm. It's again, it's a little different. We're a little different, especially these career maniacs. They're a little different.
They're a lot different. I'll mm-hmm. just go with that. But yeah. I mean, you have to be to serve that long. I mean, I look at some of my friends that stayed in for 30 years, you know, I got out after five, and you know, one, every time I see them, I'm like, man, y'all are old.
Yeah.
Cause they've been chain smoking and, you know, drinking for 30 years and hiking around with 80-pound packs when you're in your 50s is just not a really healthy thing to do. So
we had a first sergeant when I was at Fort Lewis that all the smokers he would identify, and he was so awesome. He would make us smoke on our runs. I used to smoke back in the day because I'm 52 and we all did. And so, all right, you smokers, get them out, light them up. We're going for a run. And so you'd have to light one off. You had to smoke the whole time. I don't think they'd get away with that now.
No, I don't think so either. But you know what? It was a better time in some instances.
Amen.
I know we are a lethal force, and I have no doubt about it.
Hoo-ah.
So hopefully they're becoming a lethal force again. So.
I believe that they are.
Well, thank you, Chance. Let's switch gears now. Let's talk about Fast Five questions.
Let's do it, baby.
All right, man. So first one, you wake up in the morning, business is gone. You have $500, a laptop computer, a place to live, food and clothing. What are you going to do first?
Man, I listened to so many of your episodes and I've heard what everybody said, and I feel like I'm bailing on you, bro. I would do exactly what I'm doing right now, except for I wouldn't have dope equipment. I would have my iPhone. I would spend that $500 to go get one person to convince me to do this ghetto version of a heritage film with my iPhone. And then from mm-hmm. that, I would then get a piece of equipment, get what I need, get the correct tools, and do it again by myself. Started by myself. Yeah. I would do them by, and then now I've got enough money to get a team and I would grow and grow and grow. And rather than 10 years getting to where I am now, it would take me less than a year. It's not, it's what you've done and what you know. It's, that's what matters.
Well, and you work with the tools that you have at the time. You know?
Yes, sir.
And quite frankly, I've seen stuff shot on iPhones
that
I couldn't tell. I mean, I was watching, I've been a huge fan of like the Motor Trend shows as they completely unraveled the Motor Trend network and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And those guys are now, you know, kind of over on YouTube. They're all kind of making their living on YouTube. And I've heard so many times they're like, yeah, I'm shooting this on my iPhone. And I'm like, dude, that I couldn't tell the difference between when they were shooting with professional cameras or they're shooting on an iPhone. I mean, the phones have gotten so damn good.
So good. We use an iPhone we use iPhones on every film. You know, we've got really nice Sony cameras and all that crap. But guess what? Sometimes the right tool, like we had this dude that had this sick koi pond.
Okay.
Well, I'm not dipping my freaking Sony underwater, but your iPhone, you just film the fish underwater and bring it out back under, back up somewhere. And there's a good shot. Move on to the next one.
That's awesome.
Yes, sir.
It is awesome. Okay. Second question. What's your biggest business mistake you've ever made?
Okay. I could list 1,000.
Okay.
All day. Biggest. It's like pick one. I'm going to share that early on, I had some early success and some people that signed up early. And so I did what I think all new business owners and entrepreneurs do. I got out my Excel, dude, and I started saying, I did this, so therefore I can project this, and this is where we're going. I need to use this money, hire these 5 people, buy these cameras, and then, you know,
I'll be a millionaire.
Yeah. And I literally was I had projections of like $1 million a month by year 3.
Yep.
And still waiting for $1 million a month, 10 years in.
Do you have the plan when you get there?
Yeah. I literally still have the Excel sheets. But what that caused, Mr. Kickle, is I had this delusion that I had to live with for a while. So now when I'm having real freaking awesome successes, they felt like failures because I had an unrealistic Excel spreadsheet.
Yep.
That is a massive mistake. I can't get that year back of me thinking I was something I wasn't yet. I didn't get burned enough yet.
Yeah.
There you go. That's my biggest mistake.
I mean, the advice I give every new business owner is do those projections. Now, double the amount of time that it's going to take, at least double the amount of money and subtract about half the amount of profits that you projected.
Totally.
And then you'll probably still be wrong, but at least you won't feel so bad when you do it.
But hopefully the mortgage goes through that month so that the next month you can try.
You are not a real business owner until you've had to decide to pay your employees or your mortgage. So then you become a real business owner.
I'm a real business owner from years ago. Yeah.
What's a good book that you'd recommend for our audience?
I'm going to give you two. One, I imagine you, I haven't heard anybody say it, but I only listened to 8 or so episodes. Rocket Fuel. Are you familiar with Rocket Fuel?
That one's good. Yeah. Gina
Wickman.
It's
very good. Yeah. Wickman. That one was very important to me because my wife and I run the company together and she's crazy introvert, like hide over there, not talk. And I'm me. And we learned about that book and it's like, we are cartoon characters from that book. Like I'm the visionary, she's the integrator. And I would encourage anybody that has their own thing going right now, and you may be the analytical nerd person and wonder what the WTF is going on, or you may be the spaz like me who's like, why won't the budget balance? And what you probably need is your counterpart. And we discovered that. So that's the first one that I figured would be applicable to a lot of your audience.
I think it's awesome too. And it's a great book. Yeah. I work with my wife too. So
good for you.
Kind of a weird, strange conversation we're having here.
And then one that I'd like to share with you that I would doubt anybody in your audience, but now that I know you write, maybe you have. And if you haven't, I'm telling you to get it. It's called Invisible Ink by Brian McDonald.
Not familiar with
it. Okay, good. So this is all of the McKee story, and Joseph, Hero of a Thousand Faces, Campbellian Theory, Harmon Circles. You've read all that crap. This is the best book, I'm sorry, on what a story is, about the fundamental elements of a story. And it's told using cinema, but it applies to novelization. It applies to YouTube shorts. It applies to 30-second TV commercials. Anything that is a story-based, this is the best way to understand it. And even if you're not in that creative space, reading this book will make you super appreciate the glory that is a good Hollywood movie. Of why does it work? It's called Invisible Ink by Brian McDonald, and I highly recommend it.
That's going to go on my reading list right away.
Yep.
No.
Awesome. I keep about 20 copies and I give them away. It means so much to me. It's an important book.
Well, I mean, you make your life live it, telling stories. So it's absolutely perfect. Last question. What is your definition of freedom?
That's not the last question.
Oh, that's right. Yes. Give me a tool.
I did. I listened.
You do listen. I'm impressed.
Well, and I'm also going to give the same answer that everybody says. And I'm going to say the same thing they say, which is it has a twist. But like ChatGPT and Notebook LM.
Oh,
yeah. But the way that I did it that has transformed my existence is I took a Word document. Okay, I'm lying. It was Pages because I'm a Mac guy, but Word. And I started typing everything about my business, every operation, every process, just diarrhea on the page, everything I could just say, history of the business, who I am, what we do. I had my employees, my coworkers, tell me about what they are. And I end up with this like, I made PDFs of email chains from exchanges with clients to all the Google reviews everything, and threw it all into this one Bible of my company.
Okay.
Mashed it into a PDF, uploaded to ChatGPT, uploaded into a Notebook LM to dialogue with it about what have I done? What will I do? What can I do? It has been. And by the way, every couple of weeks, I append it with new information.
Absolutely.
Man, it's a great way to use those remarkable pieces of magic.
So I'll give you an example because I use AI to write a lot of times.
For sure.
And I've used AI as I transitioned into fiction. And, you know, I'm piloting a new AI, or it's not new, but it's new to me, AI. And I just literally ran in here from the other room. I was testing it out and I'm like, so basically in ChatGPT, I created what's called Jeff Kickle style, which is my style of writing. I mean, I've basically trained it to write me.
Yes, sir.
I mean, exactly the way I would write something. And I was like, okay, let me see if I can do that in a different AI into this new one that I'm piloting. And so, you know, I kind of, do you know what Jeff Kickle style is? And it was like, I have no idea. And I said, okay, well, go out there and do some research. Come back to me with this. Okay, well, he blah, blah, blah. And it kind of, you know, because I've written a ton. Yep, it pulled all my nonfiction stuff out. And I was like, okay, now here's some examples from the novel that I'm working on of how I write. What can you glean from that? And I mean, on the tee, perfect, you know, perfect understanding of that. And I'm like, now I wonder, I wonder how that can work. Because I mean, like I said, I've gotten it to the point now where I'm the story guy.
Yeah.
And I'm using it to do the writing, you know, the part that I really don't like, the writing piece. But me being the story guy at that point. So, you know, I think it's amazing. People don't really use these AIs as much as they should.
No.
But the way you use that is absolutely amazing.
Yep.
Where it's like, hey, let me just take my whole business,
everything,
pour it into here, and then, you know, now it's a useful tool. And that's, you know, you're basically having a conversation with someone who knows all the elements of your business,
right,
and can give you that proper feedback. And it's not just this kind of generic answer that you get back a lot of times.
And then think about this on the edit side, or on a pre-show, on prep, they fill out a bunch of forms. So I'm going to know about dad. I'm going to, you know, all the basics, birthday, birthplace.
Yep.
I have a thing that says, please do not discuss. So I don't ask some Vietnam guy about Vietnam when he's fat. Yep. Like that's happened. So anyway, I get all that. Well, now I've got this Bible of the Heritage Films company that I can put into a notebook LM. And then I take all the forms about the subject I'm going to interview and I feed it in there, and it knows what the company is. It knows who I am. And now it knows a lot about the person I'm be visiting with. And it helps me create a really, really tight producer guide for me to memorize and then sit down and talk to them.
Yeah. Does that kind of include with it, maybe some events that were happening around the time that they were certain ages and stuff like that you can prompt them with?
Yeah, that's what I've been doing for 10 years. I'm like, oh,
brilliant.
Let's see. Oh, shit. They lived in, well, I'll use local. They lived in Houston. Well, I know to ask about 1961 Hurricane Carla because it screwed up. Well, I learned the versions of Hurricane Carla for Ohio in the 50s, right? That helps me with that.
That's awesome. All right, last question.
Now
you know it. No big surprise. What's your definition of freedom?
I'm going to steal from Naval Ravikant, who uses the word retiring rather than freedom, but he's talking about freedom when he says there's three definitions of retirement, which is number one, you make enough money that your money makes more money than you need or want.
Absolutely.
That's one version of freedom. Mm-hmm. Then there's the opposite of that, which is simplify your life authentically to where you have so few needs that you're free, which is like the monk or the nun or the hermit approach. You can find a hermit that is, Obi-Wan Kenobi was free. Like he was
living in a freaking cave.
He's good. Totally covered.
Life
right.
Good. Don't need any money or anything like that. Yep.
Nothing. And then the last one is when the work that you're doing looks like play to other people. And I still feel worky. I still feel anxiety and stress to get things right. And so I'm not there yet. But aspirationally, my definition of freedom is that my day-to-day existence with my family and with my company looks like play to everybody else.
Yeah. Well, but I think, you know, for you, switching gears to the financial side of Jeff, you've done a lot of the stuff that is extraordinarily important to make a business valuable, because your business could very well just be basically an overgrown job,
right?
You know, simply, but the stuff that you've done adds value
totally
because it's replicatable. you've done, you know, you've done this a ton of times. So effectively, your freedom is to be able to transition that to, okay, this is the way we do a heritage film. I can hire a videographer that does the heritage film and follows our method. Mm-hmm. And our editors follow our yep. method. And everybody in the process follows a method. And then Chance can go take off for a month or two. Yeah. And the system still runs. So
and just
done all the hard stuff.
Yeah. And just pick the films that I'm like, oh my gosh, I really yeah. wanted this dude. This dude's a Broadway
guy.
I
really want it. Yeah.
So think of it to borrow from our shared history. I have SOPs for every single thing in my job. Every job, every role, every edit, everything has books that are updated for that purpose. So that when we need a freelancer, hey, here's how we do it. Yeah. This is your job.
Yeah. This is your job. I need you to just follow the details of it. Certainly put your own personal personality into that or whatever. Everybody brings that to it, but this is the way we do a heritage film.
Yes, sir.
You know, and I mean, so you've done all the hard work, dude. You're putting yourself in the position to be able to do that. Then it's pick and choose. Hey, we can, you know, it's infinitely scalable, first off, but it's also you get to pick and choose that, you know, this is a story I need to tell. Yeah. You know, this is something that means something to me and I need to tell it at that point.
Yes, sir.
So, you know, congratulations, man. I just love what you're doing. I thought,
thank you.
As soon as I started doing a little digging in this, I was like, man, I've got to talk to this guy.
Thank you, Jeff. I love it.
Very impressive, man. Well, thanks a lot. So if anybody's interested, maybe they want to do a heritage film. Maybe they've got a farm and ranch thing. Maybe they've got something for that future stories about military and all that stuff. Where's the best place to find you and learn more?
Yeah, you can go to yourheritagefilm.com and another bit of recommendation, don't put a homophone, Y-O-U-R, not Y-O-U-R-E, yourheritagefilm.com, yourheritagefilm.com, or now you can go to Farm and Ranch Films, farmandranchfilms.com, yourheritagefilm.com, farmandranchfilms.com, that's how you find us.
Well, we need to untexanize this, too. So it's Y-O-U-R, not Y-O-R, yourheritagefilm.com.
Yourheritagefilm.com.
Yourheritagefilm. Yeah. Well, thanks so much for being on, Chance. It was an absolute pleasure, man.
Thank you, Jeff.
I just enjoyed interviewing you. You are just I'm so glad that you're out there telling people stories like this. So I love telling people stories and I love the fact that you're doing what you do. So thanks for being on the show, man. I really appreciate it.
Jeff, thank you. Thank you so much.
And folks, reach out to him. We'll put all that stuff in the show notes and make sure, as I always tell you, that you have hit that subscribe button. Love to hear comments and please share this with somebody out there who may be looking for a heritage film. So thanks a lot, and we'll see you guys back here the very next time.
Thank you for listening to the Freedom Nation Podcast. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and all the major channels. Wherever you're listening, please subscribe to the channel and leave a rating and review. If you have friends and family that could benefit from their own Freedom Day, please share with them. Finally, join Freedom Nation by following us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.